and everything was squared away. Shackleton turned and looked astern. It was just possible to make out Elephant Island as a hulking, shadowy mass. For several minutes he stared, without speaking. A forbidding-looking place, certainly, but that only made it seem the more pitiful. It was the refuge of 22 men, who at that very moment were camped on a precarious, storm-washed spit of beach, as helpless and isolated from the outside world as if they were on another planet. Their plight was known only to the 6 men in this ridiculously little boat, whose responsibility now was to prove that all the laws of chance were wrong, and return with help. It was a staggering trust. As the darkness deepened, 10,000 stars pricked through the blue-black sky, and the little wisp of a pennant that fluttered from the Caird's mainmast described an irregular circle across the sparkling heavens as the boat rolled before the quartering sea. The 2 men sat side by side, Worsley steering, and Shackleton huddled close up against him. The southerly wind was cold, and the sea was picking up. Their primary concern was ice, and Shackleton and Worsley kept a sharp lookout. They passed an occasional lump early in the evening, but by 10 o'clock the sea appeared to be clear. From time to time, Shackleton rolled cigarettes for both of them, and they spoke of many things. It was obvious that the burden of responsibility Shackleton had borne for 16 months had nibbled away somewhat at his enormous self-confidence. He wanted to talk and to be assured that he had acted wisely. He confided to Worsley that the decision to separate the party had been a desperately difficult one, and he abhorred having to make it. But somebody had to go for help, and this was not the sort of responsibility which could be delegated to another person. As for the journey itself, he seemed strangely doubtful, and he asked Worsley's opinion of their chances. Worsley replied that he was sure that they would make it, but it was evident that Shackleton was far from convinced. The truth was that he felt rather out of his element. He had proved himself on land. He had demonstrated there, beyond all doubt, his ability to pit his matchless tenacity against the elements and win. But the sea is a different sort of enemy. And like the land, where courage and the simple will to endure can often see a man through, the struggle against the sea is an act of physical combat, and there is no escape. It is a battle against a tireless enemy in which man never actually wins. The most that he can hope for is not to be defeated. It gave Shackleton a feeling of uneasiness. He now faced an adversary so formidable that his own strength was nothing in comparison, and he did not enjoy being in a position where boldness and determination count for almost nothing, and in which victory is measured only in survival. But more than anything, he was dreadfully tired, and he wanted simply for the journey to be over and as quickly as possible. If only they could make Cape Horn, he said to Worsley, they would cut 1/3 off the distance they had to go. He knew it was impossible, but he asked Worsley whether he thought the southeast wind just might hold long enough for them to do so. Worsley looked at him sympathetically and shook his head. Not a chance, he replied. Just before 6 o'clock, the first light of dawn crept across the sky, and as it grew brighter, both men relaxed. Now, if they came upon any ice, at least they could see it. Shackleton waited until 7 o'clock, and then he called the other men. Crean rigged the Primus, and after a considerable amount of trouble getting it to light and keeping the hoosh pot in place, they finally had breakfast. When they had finished, Shackleton announced that the watches would begin 4 hours on and 4 hours off. Shackleton said he would take the first trick with Crean and McNeish, and Worsley would have the other with Vincent and McCarthy. Chapter 2. To classify the dangers they faced in order of magnitude would have been impossible, but of the known threats, the greatest undoubtedly was ice, especially at night. One single collision with an unseen fragment could have ended the journey in a moment. Thus Shackleton's plan was to get north with all possible speed before turning east towards South Georgia. And for the next 2 days, they were lucky. The wind held steady out of the southwest, much of the time almost at gale force. By noon on April the 26th, they had logged a total of 128 miles from Elephant Island without encountering a sign of ice. However, those 2 days were an ordeal during which they were introduced, one at a time, to the endless miseries which constituted life on board the boat. Always and forever, there was the water, the all-pervading, inescapable water. Sometimes it was just a shower of spray thrown up from the bow and flung astern by the wind, which caused no real suffering except to the man at the helm. Much worse were the quieter, solid seas dipped up by the bow that poured aft and sloshed into the cockpit. And worst of all were the occasions when the boat plunged down just as a wave broke. Then green, foaming water rolled across the decking, splashed into the cockpit, and drained down into the boat in icy streams through a score of openings in the canvas decking, as rain might pour through the roof of some dilapidated shack. Within 24 hours after leaving Elephant Island, the decking had begun to sag, so that there were a dozen pockets to hold the water. The man at the helm, of course, suffered the most, and each of them took his turn at the yoke lines for 1 hour and 20 minutes during each watch. But the other two men on duty were better off only by comparison. When they weren't bailing or tending the sails or shifting ballast by moving the rocks in the bottom, they spent their time trying to avoid the streams coming from above. It was of little use, though. Invariably, they wound up huddled over with the water pouring off their backs. All of them were dressed more or less the same way. Heavy wool underwear, woolen trousers, a thick loose sweater, with a pair of light gabardine Burberry overalls on the outside. Their heads were covered with knitted woolen helmets and Burberry outer helmets tucked in at the neck. On their feet, they wore 2 pairs of socks, a pair of ankle-high felt boots, and finneskoes, reindeer skin boots, with the hair side out, though every trace of hair had long since worn off, leaving them bald and limp. There was not a set of oilskins on board. Such clothing was intended for wear in intense dry cold, not on board a pitching, spray-drenched boat. Here it had an almost wick-like action, soaking up every icy drop until the saturation point was reached, then maintained. The best that could be done was to live with this trial by water, as they had on the trip to Elephant Island, to sit as still as possible after each soaking so as to avoid contact with the newly drenched area of clothing. But to sit motionless in a 22-foot boat in a heavy sea can be difficult indeed. The boat had to be pumped out at fairly frequent intervals, usually 2 or 3 times each watch, and the job required 2 men, one to operate the plunger, while the other held the icy brass cylinder down into the water in the bottom of the boat. Even with mittens, the hands of the man gripping the cylinder would go numb within the space of 5 minutes, and they would trade places. Nor was the discomfort on board limited to the men on watch. They realized from the very beginning that even sleeping had a special brand of unpleasantness all its own. The sleeping bags were located in the bow, nominally the driest part of the boat. To reach them involved a tortuous crawl on hands and knees over the rocks in the bottom. The closer a man got to the bow, the more restricted the space became, until finally he had to get down on his belly and slither forward, insinuating himself between the underside of the seats and the ballast. When at last he had reached the bow, there was the job of getting into his bag, and then finally the problem of going to sleep. Fatigue helped, of course, but even so, the action of the boat in the bow was more violent than anywhere else. At times they were heaved bodily upwards, only to fall down onto the rocks again, or perhaps be slammed from beneath as the boat was pitched aloft by a new wave. The Caird had been equipped with 6 sleeping bags, so that each man might have his own, but Shackleton soon suggested that they share 3 bags and use the others as mattresses to protect them from the rocks. Everyone quickly agreed. They discovered, too, that under the decking there was not quite enough room to sit upright. For the first couple of meals, they tried to eat half-bent over, with their chins pressed down against their chests. But this position greatly interfered with swallowing, and the only thing to do was to stretch out on the rocks in the bottom. But no matter what position they assumed, sitting, reclining, or lying in their sleeping bags, the struggle against the motion of the boat was ceaseless. The 2,000 pounds of ballast in the bottom gave the Caird a particularly vicious action, and she jerked upright after every wave. Worsley thought she was over-ballasted, and he urged Shackleton to throw some of the rocks overboard. But Shackleton took a characteristically cautious view of the matter. The only way to see if Worsley was right was to dump the ballast, and then it would be gone forever. It was better, Shackleton felt, to put up with the wicked motion of the boat than to risk being light. They had sailed from Elephant Island in rather high spirits, knowing that they were embarked at last for civilization. As McNeish had recorded, "We're through, but happy through it all." But after 2 days of uninterrupted misery, their cheeriness had worn away. And by noon on April the 26th, after Worsley had fixed the position at 128 miles from Elephant Island, the ordeal to which they were committed had become altogether too real. There was only the consolation that they were making progress, at the agonizingly slow rate of about 1 mile every half hour or so. The actual position on April the 26th was 59 degrees 46 minutes south, 52 degrees 18 minutes west, and it put the Caird a scant 14 miles north of the 60th parallel of latitude. Thus they had just crept over the line separating the raving 50s from the screaming 60s, so called because of the weather that prevails there. This, then, was the Drake Passage, the most dreaded bit of ocean on the globe, and rightly so. Here, nature has been given a proving ground on which to demonstrate what she can do if left alone. The results are impressive. It begins with the wind. There is an immense area of persistent low pressure in the vicinity of the Antarctic Circle, approximately 67 degrees south latitude. It acts as a giant sump into which high pressure from farther north continually drains, accompanied by almost ceaseless gale-force westerly winds. In the prosaic, often studiously understated language of the U.S. Navy's sailing direction for Antarctica, these winds are described categorically. They are often of hurricane intensity, and with gust velocities sometimes attaining to 150 to 200 miles per hour. Winds of such violence are not known elsewhere, save perhaps within a tropical cyclone. Also in these latitudes, as nowhere else on Earth, the sea girdles the globe uninterrupted by any mass of land. Here, since the beginning of time, the winds have mercilessly driven the seas clockwise around the Earth to return again to their birthplace, where they reinforce themselves or one another. The waves thus produced have become legendary among seafaring men. They are called Cape Horn rollers, or greybeards. Their length has been estimated from crest to crest to exceed a mile, and the terrified reports of some mariners have placed their height at 200 feet, though scientists doubt that they very often exceed 80 or 90 feet. How fast they travel is largely a matter of speculation, but many sailormen have claimed their speed occasionally reaches 55 miles an hour. 30 knots is probably a more accurate figure. Charles Darwin, on first seeing these waves breaking on Tierra del Fuego in 1833, wrote in his diary, "The sight is enough to make a landsman dream for a week about death, peril, and shipwreck." As viewed from the Caird, the sight of these rollers constituted ample reason for such thoughts. In the rare moments when the sun shone, they were cobalt blue, which gave them the appearance of being infinitely deep, as indeed they were. But most of the time the sky was overcast, and then the whole surface of the sea turned a somber, lifeless grey. There was no sound to the relentless advance of these cliffs of water, except the hiss of their foaming brows when they rose to such a height, or charged forward so fast, that they lost their balance and their crests tumbled to the force of gravity. Once every 90 seconds, or less, The cared sail would go slack as one of these gigantic waves loomed astern, possibly 50 feet above her.